This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Tune in every Friday at 3 p.m. for Roots of Rock and Roll. Dale Farr and Steve Bricker play rare and vintage records from rhythm and blues, jump blues, rockabilly, and doo-wop, from the birth of rock and roll, the 50s and early 60s. Roots of Rock and Roll, only on KBOO Portland.
This Wednesday, January 23rd, KBOO will broadcast live from downtown Portland, where the Illihi Lecture Series kicks off its 2013 lecture series, Who Owns You and What You Can Do About It. With award-winning author, activist, and food policy expert Raj Patel speaking on Who Owns Our Food.
In every food riot that has happened, you've seen a demand for food linked to a demand for political change.
That's 7 this Wednesday, January 23rd. For tickets to the talk, go to illihi.org or listen live on KBOO Radio 90.7 FM.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Yellow Pages, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New mobile applications available for iPhone and Android. For more information, you can visit pdxgyp.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News...
Workers organize against a local restaurant accused of wage theft.
KBOO examines the plight of a Beaverton man panhandling for a new kidney.
Today marks the 40th anniversary of Roe v. Wade, prompting rallies from activists on both sides of the abortion debate. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, January 22nd, 2013. I'm Ren Green.
And I'm Alex Ward. Yaw's, a top-notch restaurant in northeast Portland, faced 40 protesters who made a demand for $1,200 in unpaid wages on Friday. KBOO's Robin Ryan spoke with Carrie Coe of We Are Oregon about the demonstration.
We're talking with Carrie Coe from We Are Oregon. And what's the latest? Has the restaurant responded?
So last Friday, a group of 11 workers with the support of 30-plus community members went and delivered a letter to the owner of Yaw's, top-notch restaurant, demanding unpaid wages that they were owed upwards of $1,200. And we delivered that to the restaurant itself. And the deadline for the owner to pay those wages is Wednesday, is tomorrow. So far, the workers have not received payment for their wages, but they have until tomorrow to meet the deadline, or the workers will, begin escalated action towards the restaurant. The workers were primarily they were denied wages in a lot of different ways, but it's a huge number of workers from this establishment that have been that are part of this action and this claim, which makes it, I think, pretty traditional in the service industry in Portland and the way that restaurant workers are treated. Wage theft is not an unusual thing for folks to face, whether that's unpaid trainings or getting deductions taken out of their paycheck or, not getting breaks or not getting lunch breaks and things like that. So, our experience is that wage theft is really common, and we are, we're excited that the workers of Yaw's have decided to come forward and pursue getting their unpaid wages paid back to them.
And can you tell me anything about the formula that was used to arrive at the $1,200 figure?
It's calculated based on their their wages, what they were being paid at the time, and the amount of time that they either worked that they didn't get paid for, or, you know, tips that they were supposed to have received that they didn't get, or in what we believe to be illegal deductions that were taken out of their paycheck. So, you know, it's a paperwork trail that we've collected with the workers, that the workers themselves have collected, that we have presented to the owner, so he has all of the math in front of him and can see for himself that these workers were shorted in their wages.
Over how long a period of time?
Well, the restaurant just opened in October, so it's been over the last few months that this has been happening.
Has there been any dialogue in the interim?
So the workers, some of the workers have been contacted by management at Yaz, and Yaz has said various things to various workers. But our experience with management is that until we have a check in hand, you can't, it's not a done deal. So we are in conversation, but so far none of the workers have received their pay. It's an interesting story because Yaz, Top Notch Restaurant, actually has a sort of historic place in Portland history. It was opened during the 1950s years, where a lot of folks from Portland have very fond memories of this restaurant, of like having really good life experiences there. It was a very popular hangout for high school youth back when it was located in the Hollywood district. So the fact that Yaz has this like family legacy and says that they treat their employees like family and wants to be so respected by the Portland community, it's even more of a shame that they have taken this tack of treating their employees as disposable and as not worth being paid. So in that way, we feel like, there's even more capacity to put public pressure on Yaz to do the right thing if that's needed.
And I want to thank Carrie Coe of We Are Oregon for her time today.
We Are Oregon runs a wage theft campaign, and that this is, as I said earlier, not an uncommon phenomenon. And if folks out there listening have been the victims of wage theft, the wage theft hotline is 503-345-7831. And we really encourage anybody who has not had all of their wages or who hasn't been getting their breaks or has had illegal deductions to give us a call, and we can talk about what we can do about that.
To mark the occasion of Martin Luther King's birthday yesterday, the group United for a Fair Economy released its annual State of the Dream report, which showed that Black and Latino families suffered disproportionately from the nation's latest recession. Racial minorities lost a greater portion of wealth during the Great Recession than white families, and they had less wealth to begin with due to historical prejudices that kept Black and Latino families from owning their own homes and investing in stocks and bonds. Home value accounts for roughly half of the total assets held by Black and Latino families, but only 28% of total assets held by white. This dependence on home ownership to create wealth plus puts minority families at a huge disadvantage. The report argues that federal investments in housing policy should be directed more towards treating housing as a human right and less toward encouraging home ownership as a strategy to create wealth. The group recommended using race as a factor to help correct the wealth disparity between white people and communities of color in the United States. They called for investing in affordable housing and encouraging alternative models to build community wealth, such as cooperative ownership structures.
The Portland School Board is meeting tonight to discuss plans for balancing student populations in the Jefferson School Cluster. School officials announced several proposals last week that would close some of the schools in the cluster, all of which are located in North or Northeast Portland. Some of the schools to be discussed for possible closure include Woodlawn and Vernon Elementary Schools, as well as Ockley Green Middle School. Parents are concerned that closing more schools in the Jefferson Cluster will add to the instability that students, teachers, and families are currently dealing with. A study session on the issue starts tonight at 6 p.m. at the district office located on Northeast Dixon Street. A discussion on the Jefferson Cluster proposals starts at 7:45 p.m.
As the debate on gun control continues throughout the country, local gun control advocates have organized a panel in Portland this evening to talk about possible solutions. The forum will take place from 6:30 to 8 tonight at Bridger Elementary School, located at Southwest 79th and Market Street in Portland. This event is hosted by the Oregon-based Political Action Committee known as the Mother Pack, which promotes paid sick leave, flexible work schedules, and affordable childcare. The group has called on local residents to participate in tonight's panel, which is called Gun Violence, Let's Talk Solutions. Attendees will have a chance to speak with local legislators and officials on the issue of gun control.
The operators of a no-kill animal shelter appeared in court today to answer charges of animal neglect. Alicia English, owner of Willamette Animal Rescue, was charged with 100 counts of animal neglect and one count of evidence tampering. On January 13th, more than 130 malnourished and disease-ridden animals were seized at the shelter, which was located in a warehouse in Brooks, Oregon. According to the Statesman Journal, the no-kill shelter ran into problems shortly after it opened less than 2 years ago. After failing to complete registration necessary for nonprofits, the shelter was threatened with legal action by the Department of Justice. State and Marion County officials also started receiving complaints about dirty and unkept animals from the shelter at adoption events. After falling behind on her vet bills, English stopped providing veterinary care for the dogs last September. Employees of a home remodeling business located next to the shelter complained of foul smells and barking that was, quote, horrendous. Willamette Animal Rescue has no employees and was operated by English and two other board members who also appeared in court today.
The Mohammed Mohammed trial underway in Portland was given a day off today, reportedly due to illness. KBOO's Joe Meyer has been attending the trial of the so-called Christmas tree bomber and filed this report.
Judge King canceled court today, and the trial of Mohammed Mohammed was given the holiday and the bonus sick day. After a day and a half for jury selection, both sides outlined their cases in the opening statements Friday afternoon, January 11th. The facts of the case are a little disputed. On November 26th, 2010, the defendant was driven by an undercover agent in a white van to Pioneer Square. He did follow the FBI agent's instruction and seemed to connect wires in the back of the van. He was driven to another location by the FBI agent and again, following the instructions of the FBI agent, did dial the cell phone. Pamela Holslinger gave the government's opening statement and argued that the defendant was already radicalized when they found him and that the FBI intervened at a critical moment. She promised to show the defendant's writings and FBI tapes to prove her case. Stephen Sadie opened for the defense and started by arguing for the importance of the entrapment defense, stating that the FBI cannot create the crime they solve, and that this time they just went too far. Mr. Sadie promised evidence showing the FBI targeted the defendant because of the intelligence that he was easily manipulated, religiously confused, financially vulnerable, using drugs, and having family problems. The public defendant flourished his argument with, "Conflicted and sad is not a predisposition to crimes of mass destruction." Almost every morning opened with 20 minutes of legal arguments about what evidence the jury is allowed to see. This happens before the jury is seated, and my understanding is the FBI planning meetings and debriefs will not be allowed. Further, the FBI forgot to turn off their recorders after several meetings with the defendant, and these so-called outtakes have an interesting status. If the undercover agent gives testimony that factually conflict what is on the outtake, then the defense is allowed to play the tape. Since the outtakes are powerful evidence for the defense, this has made for very exciting cross-examinations, and the FBI witnesses have been flawless. The issue of missing FBI tapes at critical moments is also a regular theme. Also interesting procedurally is that the jury sent Judge King a note asking for a definition of entrapment. The judge considered this for one day and responded that he wanted the jury to hear evidence first and would provide the definition with the usual jury instructions after both sides rest. The prosecution gets to go first and started with emails and published writings of the defendant. He wrote four articles for Jihad Recollections and communicated by email with dangerous people in Yemen. Prosecution then showed tapes of meetings between the defendant and undercover FBI agents known as Yusuf and Hussein. Yusuf was posing as an Al-Qaeda recruiter, and Hussein was an Al-Qaeda bomb expert and marijuana dealer. The first video shown by the government was taken at the embassy suites in downtown Portland on August 18, 2010. Mohammed was seated on the floor surrounded by cartons of takeout food. Agents Hussein and Yusuf were standing and walking above him. The government argues that the tape shows that the agents kept giving the defendant a way out, saying repeatedly that there was no shame in stopping and that he always wanted to go forward. The defense countered that, although the agents indeed used the words, you can stop, they were always couched in language which made this a false choice. The pattern was to first praise the defendant, then glorify the task, then make the you can get out noise, and then quickly change the subject. Most of the government's arguments consisted of asking the FBI witnesses, why did you say that you can always get out? And the witness replying, because we wanted him to know that he could get out. The defense countered that the FBI used sophisticated social science techniques, including risk and reward, praise, religious language, and authority figures to manipulate a vulnerable youth. As to the defendant, he seems to be in good health and carries a calm disinterestedness. The trial continues tomorrow at 1000 Southeast 3rd Avenue, downtown Portland. On this very spot, every day during Occupy camps, a man marched up and down with a megaphone shouting, "Free all political prisoners! Free all political prisoners!" and a boy called Nameless followed him with a drum. The government is expected to call civilian and expert witnesses in addition to the FBI agent known as Elvis Chan. Mr. Chan from San Francisco is undercover agent Youssef's handler and was present at the famous first meeting where the tape recorder didn't work. Plenty of good seats are still available 9 to 5 at 1000 Southeast 3rd Avenue, downtown Portland. And I'm Joe Meyer with KABU News.
The second leading cause of lung cancer is on the rise in Portland. Radon, a radioactive gas created by the breakdown of uranium in the soil, can be found in approximately 1 in 4 houses in the Portland area. A newly completed study from Portland State University found that radon levels in some areas had risen considerably since 2004. The Environmental Protection Agency estimates that radon is responsible for 20,000 deaths from lung cancer annually. Mitigating the effects of radon in your home can cost between $350 and $2,500. A forum discussing radon gas will be held on January 24th by Cascade Radon and will include speakers from Portland State University and the American Lung Association.
High-speed rail could soon become a reality for Oregon if a statewide commission is able to convince the freight company Union Pacific that it's worth the expense. The Oregon Passenger Rail Leadership Council is conducting a study to look at ways to improve the Amtrak Cascade routes, including high-speed trains. The council is made up of mayors, legislators, and state and local transit officials. They will choose one of 4 corridor concepts by the fall of 2014. Eugene Mayor Kitty Piercy notes that people like the idea of faster rail travel, but they are more interested in frequency and reliability, which has been a major problem with Amtrak in the past. Amtrak passenger trains share the rails with Union Pacific. Union Pacific moves freight and wants speeds restricted to 70 miles per hour. Union Pacific is currently upgrading their tracks to 79 miles per hour, but upgrading them to 90 miles per hour for high-speed trains would involve additional expense. One of the reasons for considering high-speed rail is the consistent population growth in the Willamette Valley. By 2035, the population in the Willamette Valley is expected to reach over 3.5 million.
You are listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News at 5:30, followed by Out Loud, KABU's queer culture radio show, at 6. And at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is rain all day with a high near 42.
It's 5:19, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
The once haughty Tea Party has been whittled down to only a nub of its former self, with only 8% of Americans now identifying themselves with a faction. And no wonder. The fiery movement that sprang from legitimate anger over the government bailout of Wall Street banksters quickly got co-opted by Republican political operatives fronting for those same banksters and for such corporate extremists as the Koch brothers. By brandishing the plutocratic agenda of those elites, the party's popular support has dwindled to a nub that's nutty, focusing on what one Republican leader calls tinfoil hat issues. For example, a top agenda item for today's withered Tea Party is a full-bore howling assault on something that isn't even there. A nefarious United Nations plot to destroy American freedom and establish a UN dictatorship over us. Yes, the same international debating society that the right wing used to mock as meek and weak is presently being recast as a fearsome totalitarian behemoth brazenly stripping our sovereignty from us. The UN's weapon is not some secret army, but a piece of paper. Titled Agenda 21, it's just a series of non-binding UN recommendations to encourage sustainable economic growth in developing nations through voluntary actions. It's an innocuous document with zero force behind it, passed way back in 1992 with the support of Republican President George Bush. Some threat. But in recent months, Agenda 21 was turned into a foaming-at-the-mouth cause by the nattering nabob of nuttiness, Glenn Beck. So Beck's disciples have been waving the tattered Tea Party banner and rushing to the barricades to, by God, defend America from this piece of paper. This is Jim Hightower saying, the wonder is that even 8% of the public has stuck with the Tea Party.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
A Beaverton man was recently seen standing along the highway holding a sign saying he needed a kidney transplant. Mike Seeley, the executive director of the Pacific Northwest Transplant Bank, talked with KBOO's Don Merrill about how and why the man was out there panhandling for a kidney and what the public needs to know about the organ donor process.
There is a shortage of organs in the United States. There probably always will be. So for kidney transplantation, there can be a donation from someone who's died and donated their kidney if they happen to be meeting the circumstances to donate their organs at the time of their death. That's what our agency handles here. And then the transplant programs all have living kidney transplant programs. Every patient is considered for living donation at the same time as they're listed, for the most part, for what we call cadaveric donation.
So does that mean that someone could see this man and go to his or her physician and say, I want to donate a kidney to this man?
Well, you know, potentially. In theory, you draw attention and people say, well, I would like to donate my kidney to this individual. The problem with this is... We already have a system in place where family members of a particular patient, members of their community, people known to them for the most part, can have potentially be potential donors. And, you know, if they meet the initial screening, which is a phone conversation, then they go on to have diagnostic tests, and there's a lot involved in that.
Apparently he has insurance that will pay for the transplant, but of course the issue isn't paying, although it is an issue for a lot of people. You know, how will it get funded?
This is an issue of supply of organs, so it's not an issue of access to health care. That you're right, that's a big problem in this country. What I always would suggest, and I would encourage patients who feel that need to find other avenues, which usually are futile, that they should contact their transplant program, talk to their nurse coordinator about any ideas they have. Social media has come into play here, and it is a reality where people have put that same interest plea out through Facebook and other things. And sometimes that connects people who are viable candidates, and the system generally, I'm talking in general for transplant programs, you know, they can take on two or three patients at a time to screen and see if they're viable, but they have to go through the patient himself, herself. The system is very exacting as far as when, how an organ that becomes available from a magnanimous gift or a donation through the deceased donor pool, which is the larger source of organs, essentially. There are various algorithms or rules in place that allow for the allocation of that organ based on many, many factors. As far as access, I think that's a larger discussion in culture.
The reason why I bring that up is because, you know, anybody over a certain age can remember the controversy around Mickey Mantle and his liver transplant.
Sure.
Back in the mid-90s. And, I mean, for people who don't remember, Mickey Mantle had cirrhosis of the liver.
Right.
He got the transplant and then he died. There was always a question of, how fair is the system?
Mickey Mantle was the sickest patient on that regional waiting list at that time. Keep in mind that some large percentage of liver failure in the United States is caused by cirrhosis, which could be caused by viral factors, or alcohol. Patients are screened for their ability to remain in recovery. They're not going to be put on a transplant list if they can't be good stewards of the organ. He met all those criteria. And so it's an ethical issue. Do you go to that patient who has waited as long as anyone in that regional list, the way the list was set up at that time, and say to Mr. Mantle, you know, you're famous. We're going to wait. It's like the lottery. He wouldn't be offered an organ again. The difference here is that he had access to health care maybe over other people at that time. This meaning he had health care insurance, and he would have needed insurance back in those days to get transplanted. But the fact is he waited as long as anyone. He was in recovery the acceptable amount of time and didn't drink afterwards. And his death was caused by a cancer at a cellular level. And transplant patients in general are more susceptible to cancers because of they're on immune suppressive medication. But the fairness issue is a larger discussion in culture. You know, how can we make sure that people have access to what they need? And the safeguard that the system is fair and balanced.
That was KBOO's Don Merrill talking with Pacific Northwest Transplant Bank Executive Director Mike Seeley.
Biotech giant Amgen was one of a number of megacorporations that received a $500 million taxpayer-funded gift as part of the fiscal cliff deal. The fiscal cliff bill, which recently passed both chambers of Congress by overwhelming majorities, was promoted as a way to reduce the deficit. However, it ended up adding $74 billion in spending due to tax breaks for the rich and tax gifts for corporations like Amgen. The bill allows the firm to sell Sensipar, a drug for kidney dialysis patients, without price regulations for the next 2 years. Amgen pleaded guilty just 2 weeks earlier for illegally marketing Aranacep, developed to combat anemia, but settled that matter for $762 million. The company's annual income is $15.6 billion. That figure is likely to increase as they raise the prices on kidney dialysis drugs without regulation for the next 2 years.
Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid met today with the Democratic caucus to discuss reforming the Senate rules on filibusters. The, quote, talking filibuster, promoted by Oregon Senator Jeff Merkley, is unlikely to be included in the reform package. Laws today are extremely lax on filibusters, which allow a party to delay or entirely prevent a vote on a given proposal. A growing majority of Democrats in the Senate support a talking filibuster where the senator must stand at the pulpit and make his case to the floor to delay legislation. Here's a clip of Senator Merkley talking with KBOO News last month about his proposal to bring back the talking filibuster.
The way it works now is that you have a unanimous consent request to have a final vote. And when a senator objects to that unanimous consent request, then you have the start of a filibuster. But there's no requirement for anyone to speak. It used to be folks who opposed the majority vote wanted to make their case to their colleagues and to the American people, but no longer. And so you have these silent filibusters. A talking filibuster says, no, if a substantial minority vote for additional debate, there will be additional debate. Folks will be required to come to the floor and make their case, and people can judge them heroes or bums. But it gives a chance for the public to see what's happening and to provide feedback for people to take responsibility for their obstruction of the Senate. The general understanding of the Senate until recent times was it's a majority body and that you didn't get in the way of that core principle unless it was an issue that went right to the heart of your principles or your state's needs. And it was normally done by a small group or a small faction on something. But now it's become an instrument of the minority party to simply object on every motion, on every bill, to a simple majority vote, thereby wasting a week of the Senate's time. And so that's the other value of the talking filibuster, as it says if you're going to propose wasting time, you're going to have to spend time and energy to do so. It isn't that the rules have changed, it's that the social contract has changed. When people filibustered Voting Rights Acts in the 1960s, they did so because they wanted to take responsibility for the fact that they were obstructing the simple majority. They wanted the folks back home to know their position. But now it's more of a party strategy to paralyze the Senate. In this case, Mitch McConnell said his top priority was to keep President Obama from getting reelected. And one way to do that is make sure no legislation gets to his desk.
That was Oregon Senator Jeff Merkley speaking on his proposal to bring back the talking filibuster. The Democratic caucus is not likely to support the talking filibuster, saying after today's meeting that they are trying to work with Republicans to create a reform package that the Republicans will also agree to.
Today marks the 40th anniversary of the landmark Supreme Court case, Roe v. Wade, which affirmed a woman's legal right to have an abortion. In Portland, anti-abortion activists gathered in Pioneer Square over the weekend to call for an end to women's right to choose. The Oregonian newspaper claims that 1,000 people attended the rally, but witnesses say the number was actually much lower, although participants were bussed in from all over the state. Michelle Stranger Hunter, the executive director of the reproductive rights group Neural Oregon, spoke with KABU about the significance of today's anniversary.
40 years ago, in 1973 today, the Supreme Court made a landmark decision saying that a woman had a right to access abortions legally. And that changed everything in America, at least for 20 years of that time. So until about 1992, it really assured that women, no matter where you lived, you could access safe legal abortion. 20 years ago, in 1992, there was another Supreme Court case that came down, and that one allowed states to put, individual states to put their own restrictions on access, which is why we have the mess we have today. Today, we have only 8 states in the country that do not have any legal restrictions against a woman's access. In Oregon, we're very lucky to be restriction-free. So I can say I am commemorating the 40th anniversary of Roe v. Wade. I can't honestly say I'm celebrating, because in most parts of America today, women have less access than they've had in 40 years. Since the election of 2010, when we had a real shift in an addition of Republican